Okay, well, without waiting any further, I'd like to introduce someone who I've known for a while through this meeting, and someone who has a real way to talk about winning, our very own Thursday Night Warlock, Josiah B.
Duh. I'm Josiah. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon and proud to say that the 7 o'clock La Cunada Men's Stag Al-Anon meeting is my home group. It's good to be here. Yeah, that's right. It's nice to be in front of a group of so many familiar faces, some of whom still like me. Welcome to the newcomers. It's good to have you here. I hope after you get done hearing me tonight, you'll have a little bit of an understanding of what Al-Anon is and a little bit of an attraction to what we do. Happy birthday to all the birthday people. And I need to thank Steve F. Steve, thank you for asking me to be here. Steve is one of the most enthusiastic and eager members of program that I know. I don't think he's had an indifferent moment in his life, right? Never bored. Really grateful to have an opportunity to speak, and whenever I get a chance to stand at the bully pulpit, I like to make a point of talking about the steps in Al-Anon. Our literature says that if we willingly surrender ourselves to the spiritual discipline of the 12 steps, our lives will be transformed. And we come in here in pain and confusion and anger and fear because of someone else's drinking. And I don't know if any of the rest of you are or were like me, but I came in here absolutely beside myself because my teenage daughter was drinking and using drugs, and I had tried everything. I mean, I had tried everything. I could have written a handbook on the different things that one could do to try to get that stuff under control. Unfortunately, that handbook would be one of failed and frustrated attempts because my daughter was always a step ahead of me. And so I was told about Al-Anon. I came in here when my daughter, as I said, was a teenager, and I went to various meetings around here, including this one, and I waited for you to tell me how it was that I was going to get her to stop and how I was going to get it under control. And I heard none of that. I can't tell you what I did here because I was only listening for that one thing, and I didn't stick around. I wanted to figure out a way to make it stop, you know, and yelling at her and grounding her and going through all her belongings, going through the lint trap in the dryer, taking the bedroom door off its hinges. None of that stuff worked. And so, you know, they say never try to teach a pig to sing, right? It frustrates you and angers the pig. Well, and that's what I was doing. And so... But what happened was even the Baptist boot camp in Texas that her mother sent her to, a year-long program that at about 11 months she ran barefoot into the Texas night, and they said, okay, we're done with her, you all take her back. And her mother, who does not have program but clearly has a little bit of clarity about the right thing to do, said, you take her. And because I had the guilt of a divorced parent, I said, okay. And I took her. And I found myself doing all kinds of crazy things, and I didn't think that she was using. It's been suggested to me since that she probably was, and had gotten way more clever about it. But at any rate, I was crazy still, and acting in all kinds of bizarre and inappropriate ways, and not very happy, and really didn't want to have, you know, a 20-year-old roommate of any ilk, much less my daughter. And right about that same time, I started dating a sober alcoholic who was dabbling in Al-Anon. And I saw one of the Al-Anon books on a table of hers, and I noticed it and recognized it. I mentioned it to her, and she said, yeah, you know, I've been going a little bit, and you might want to try it. And I thought, well, if for no other reason than to make it a fair fight with her, maybe I should, just, you know, so that I knew the code. You know? Didn't take me long to figure out what she was saying when she said, you might be right. I thought she was being agreeable. We all know what that really means. The most unlikely thing happened, though, when I came back. What happened was I finally heard the message, and the message was, you're probably not going to be able to do a thing about that daughter of yours and how she acts. But if you're willing to look at yourself, you might be able to make some changes in your own life that will make you happier and more comfortable and maybe even contend with her more successfully. What I've come to understand in the years since is that that's what we do. You know, an alcoholic comes into AA and they say, the drinking is your problem. You need to stop. The alcoholic puts the bottle down forever, walks away, and goes about his or her life. But what we do is we come in here and say, this alcoholic isn't just anybody. This alcoholic is my daughter, my son, my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, my spouse. I don't want to walk away from my problem forever the way the alcoholic does. I want to learn how to have a balanced and appropriate relationship with that person. So Al-Anon, if you were to put it in AA terms, is really like telling the alcoholic, it's okay, you can have two beers a day, but only two. And so in many ways, I've been told and I believe that Al-Anon is the graduate program. Because much like people in eating programs or spending programs or sex programs, we try to walk into the cage and live with the tiger. And so I tried to figure out for a long time why it made sense for us, you, me, anybody, to sit in church basements on folding chairs in drafty rooms week after week after week. Why are we doing this? Well, what I've come to learn and what I get to see on a weekly basis at this meeting in particular is that we do that because, as someone said when they took a birthday cake, it works. And I will tell you that my life is immeasurably better today than it was when I first came in. I'm blessed to be able to sponsor a good number of men in this meeting, and I can tell you that their lives get better too. And what I know is that if you show up to meetings occasionally and hear some of the things that are talked about, you will hear some things that you might be able to take out there in your life and try to apply. You will get some awarenesses about yourself that will allow you to do things a little bit differently, and your life will get better. But in what I think is sometimes the best kept secret in Al-Anon, this is a 12-step program. And if you actually use the 12 steps and take the 12 steps, your life will get even better. And so when I get a chance to tell my story, I like to tell it by going through the steps and talk about my understanding and my experience with them. And part of that experience with them is not only with the men I sponsor, gentlemen, thank you for that, but also the work I've done with my sponsor, Carl. God bless you. I love you. And what I'll tell you is that when I first came in, I was pulled up short and had a problem almost immediately because the first step said that I was powerless over alcohol. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol is the first half of that. And my first thought was, no, she's powerless over alcohol. She needs to take the first step. And what I've come to learn since then is that what we're saying when we talk about that in Al-Anon is that we're powerless over alcohol as it manifests in that person. And it took me a minute because I thought, I changed that child's diapers. I fed her. I housed her. I drove her to school and to the movies and to the mall. And it went blah. And so don't tell me I'm powerless. But clearly I was, especially because by that time she outsmarted me at every turn. She was going to use. And in the years that have gone since, I can tell you that she's going to do what she's going to do, whether it's because of drugs or anything else. And I truly am powerless. I was when she was 14 and I am today. And that means the bad news is I'm powerless over that thing that bothers me the most, but what's left is that I'm not powerless over me. Now, the problem is not only am I powerless over alcohol, but my life had become unmanageable. And my favorite first step story about my relationship with my daughter is the time when she was a teenager and I'd gotten a call and she was at somebody's house and there was a problem. I drive over in the family minivan across town. I know, it's a sight, isn't it? As I remember, there's police cars and lights and things like that, and there had been something in a bag that they were breathing into, whatever it was. And so I come get her, put her in the car, and I'm driving back across Glendale to take her home and doing what we Al-Anons do. Wah, 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 wah. Right? I'm yapping at her again. I'm yapping at her yet again. And I'm sure I thought of a brand new, clever way to say it, and I'm sure I was saying it even more loudly and in an even more angry tone. And I was so convincing that when we got to a stoplight, she opened the door and bailed. Whoosh, into the night. And so I'm behind the wheel of the car, the door's open, I'm at a light, and I was frozen. Absolutely powerless over alcohol. It was running into the night. And my life was completely unmanageable. I didn't know whether to drive, whether to close the door, whether to chase her. And to this day, I can't remember what happened next, other than that, you know, I ended up at home eventually, and she ended up at home eventually, and off we went. But to me, that just tells me exactly how the first step works for an Al-Anon. Exactly. So when I'm able to look at my life through the lens of the first step, I start to realize. And part of my pitch in Al-Anon is a very male pitch. It's a very masculine pitch. You know, Al-Anon was started by the wives of the alcoholics, typically. And my experience in Al-Anon, my first one, was a little meeting up the street. And it was, you know, women knitting. And I was the only guy. And God bless them. They said, you know, you might want to try tomorrow night down the street. But it's a little bit different, I think, for men, because, you know, we figure things out. You know, we fix things. We have wrenches. And we don't stop and ask for directions. You know, and the icon in our culture is John Wayne. You know? And as I think it was Eddie or somebody said in their birthday thing, you know, here we are standing holding hands going, oh my God, I'm in a 12-step group. You know, John Wayne would never have been in a 12-step group, right? And so for me to admit that I'm powerless over my daughter especially was really difficult. I don't have to think very long to come up with episodes like that one with the van and the night and the door and the girl gone to say, oh, yes, you are. You know, and I absolutely have to stop and say, okay, I guess I'm powerless. And clearly, if I think about it, my life is unmanageable. The dance I was doing with this child. And so what happens next is that, okay, well, there's the first step. What now? The first step really defines the problem for us. And what I was taught is that the next 11 steps help us to craft a solution. Second step says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I don't have a problem with the implication that I'm insane, but I do have a little bit of a problem with capitalizing the power greater than myself thing. And we'll talk a little bit about what the God stuff is in the program to me and the men that I sponsor. But what I've come to believe is that the power greater than myself that might restore me to sanity doesn't have to be anything more or bigger than just the men who come ahead of me, my sponsor, the literature, the power of being at a meeting. And when I realized that, I thought, okay, you know, here are some men who have done this before, and they have daughters and wives and sisters and employers and whatever it is, and they've and Lee, 19 years, congratulations. You know, all these men seemed to be happy. I would walk into the Thursday night meeting and these guys were hugging each other and laughing and having a good time. And I'm thinking, clearly you don't have a daughter who's behaving the way mine is. And that's just not so. In many cases, it's worse. And so that's how I wrap my head around that second step. You know, the second step for us means that we're going to turn to someone else to get a different idea. There was no way I could yell louder. I'd said everything I needed to say. And so then the question becomes, now what? Third step then says that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I came into Al-Anon with some reluctance. I came and I left and then I came back and I still wasn't completely convinced. Feeling a little bit like, you know, why am I in a 12-step group? But also feeling that if you could help me, that would be great, but I don't want it to be religious, and I don't even know that I believe in God. I don't know that I really want to believe in God, and I don't know how hard I want to work around this idea of God. But the Al-Anon literature, and thankfully the AA literature, is actually really easy with that stuff. You know, my understanding is that when the AA literature was written, there were some people who were atheistic, or at least not very religious, and they were telling the authors of the book, you need to tone it down for those of us who don't believe that. And so the experience in 12-step groups over the decades has been that if you believe in God, great, we want you to rely on God. But if you don't, that doesn't have to be a deal breaker. And you can be a successful member of a 12-step program, and you can go through the steps without any problem. And my experience has been that I could make a decision to turn my will and my life over to not have to be in control without having to know what it was or who it was that I've turned it over to. And my experience with the God part of the program has been that the less I try to define it, the less I oppose it because of my historical relationship with religion, the more open I can be to the idea that there is something or someone or who knows what that can help me. I sponsor a handful of atheists. I mean militant, no way, there is nothing that exists, atheists. And I've watched them go through the steps and have amazing transformations. And what I believe is that the less you believe in God and the more atheistic you are, the more faith and trust you have to have in something. You know, if you're going to surrender your life and you think there's a God, easy. If you think there's nothing and you're still going to make a decision to surrender your life, man, that's tough. And so the third step for me is really a matter of trying to do things differently, trying to do things right. And what I get to do is I get to show up and do my best efforts and not have to madly control all the results. And so I can be present for my daughter and try to have a healthy relationship with her. Whether she wants a relationship with me or not is up to her. And whether she completely derails her life is up to her. This is a little bit more difficult if the person in your life who's an alcoholic is a youngster, but that was my experience. My experience was by that time my daughter was going to do what she's going to do. And, you know, it's been a lot of years since that I look back now and I think about all the things I worried about and I see how she's pretty much just fine and I think, okay. And the idea of turning my will and my life over has another kind of a wrinkle for Al-Anon, and that is that not only do I have to understand that I've got to surrender my life at some level, my will, but I also get to surrender hers. And a part of this idea of surrendering it to a higher power when it comes to my alcoholic, or alcoholics, as it turns out, is that I have to understand that she has a higher power in her life, and I'm not it. And I didn't know that. I did not know that. Surrendering my will and my life to the care of God as I understood him. At one point, I just had this vision that I would lay in bed in the morning when I woke up and said, okay, God, ready? Go. Ready? Go. And so my experience is that I'm not going to be transported. I'm not going to have visions. The clouds aren't going to part. But my business is to get up, make the bed, have breakfast, and go to work. You know, do the stuff I know that's in front of me to do, and then surrender how that turns out. Just let it go. You're going to show up at work on time and do your job the way they pay you to do it. Whether your boss likes it, whether you have a client, whether you get a paycheck, at some level, beyond that, is out of my control. So the first three steps just really give me a way of looking at my life that helps me to take my death grip off of the things outside of me that I'm trying so desperately to control. It's asking me to believe that it'll be okay if I don't know how it's going to go. Asking me to believe that it's going to be okay even if things go kind of badly. I do as much as I can, and when I realize that it's out of my control, I have to stop. So now that we've got me a little bit less crazed, then we start to work on me. And that starts at the fourth step, where it says we make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I've got to tell you, when I first came in and heard that, I said, no, I'm not the one with the problem, and boy, can I make a searching and fearless moral inventory of her. In detail. I could absolutely make an inventory of her. But, hearken back to the first step, what we've decided is that I'm powerless over her. And it doesn't matter how clear I am about what her problem is. It doesn't matter how clear I am on what she should do. All that matters is that if I believe that I have no control over her, and I'm the only piece that I get to work on, then I'd better figure out what the deal is with me. I came in, and because of denial and arrogance, I thought that I didn't have a problem that she did, and that I needed to fix her problem. By the time I get to the point of taking an inventory, what I've started to realize is that might not be entirely true. And so I go about the business of taking an inventory of myself, trying to figure out a couple of different things. One, what are the behaviors that I engage in that are unhealthy? And then two, to get below that, what are the things that I believe about myself and my world that drive those behaviors? And so I can tell you that I absolutely want to control that child of mine. I want to tell her what to do, even as an adult. I want her to do the right thing so I don't have to be upset. Now, the behaviors I engage in are things like, she'll say something along the lines of, I want to go shopping, but I have no money. Only she doesn't say it like that. Oh. The child has a gift for drama. She must get it from her mother. I want to go shopping. I want to go to the mall, but I have no way to get there. Okay, honey. Wallet and keys in hand, right? I don't want there to be any unhappiness. I feel responsible for it. I'm uncomfortable with it. I get my keys out. Now, it doesn't matter if I'm watching the game, or if I'm going to go out, or if I don't really have the spare cash. I do it anyway. That's just one of dozens of behaviors I can recognize that are unhealthy about the way I interact with my child. I try to understand what the reasons behind that are. Well, some of them are very selfish. I don't want there to be any discord in my home. I'd rather just give you the money and send you away, right? Stop. Or guilt because I divorced her mother when she was a little tiny child, or whatever. So I go through my inventory, and she's on it, and, you know, ex-wives are on it, employers are on it. I try to figure out where it is I engage in unhealthy behaviors. And once I've done all of that stuff, I then go to the fifth step, which says, we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And my experience with that is basically, I'm going to sit down with the sponsor, who by the time I finally get to my fifth step knows a little bit something about me, and tell him what I've come up with. And I've done dozens and dozens of fifth steps with men that I sponsor. And basically what happens, at least in fifth steps in Al-Anon with men that I sponsor, is a couple of things. Sometimes we figure it out and we go, yeah, boy, you got that right. It's good to see that you've got some awareness about yourself. Another one, especially with us, is I can't believe how horrifying it was and I'm such a terrible person and oh my God. I can't tell you how many times I've looked at men that I sponsor and say, that had nothing to do with you. You're not responsible for that. We have a tendency to take it all on and think it's all our fault and then have to fix it. And so when I sit down with a sponsor who knows a little bit something about me, he can tell me, let go of that, you're not responsible for it. And then the beauty is that the other side of that coin is you'll go flying by something and say, yeah, well, so this person acted really badly and then that happened and that's why I have a resentment and that's why they're on my inventory. And you go, whoa, whoa, back up. You did what? And so sometimes we get straightened out and because we can't see it. You know, a big part of the reason that we take the steps and we do these inventories is because this stuff is so automatic. It's so knee-jerk. I believe that a big reason we act the way that we do is because of our upbringing. I mean, how many of us come into Al-Anon and, whether we know it or not, realize at some point that there's alcoholism in our family? You know, our literature talks a lot about how alcoholism is a family disease and we are all affected. I came in here convinced that my daughter was the problem. I didn't know much about my family. Neither of my parents were in any way in touch with their parents. I didn't have grandparents in my family or nephews or cousins or whatever those things are. I didn't have them. And so I started to learn a little bit more about my past. And I've come to find out that my father's father, raging alcoholic, fist fights and craziness. And so what I know about myself is that the reason that I act in an unhealthy way around my alcoholic is an honest and true one. It is that's what I learned. And it's really confounding, but I found that out about my past. And I actually tracked down one of my father's half-sisters about 10 years ago and sat in her little house in Arizona and had her tell me the story of my alcoholic family that I never knew. And I listened to suicides and overdoses and divorce and all kinds of craziness, and I just went, huh, yep. Those are my people. And what a weight it took off. I always thought that I was just really broken. And now I realize I'm just a member of that family. I was never very happy about my father being so mysterious about it, but that was his decision. So I just get to figure out a way to get over it. So a big part of the reason that I act the way that I act, and I see it over and over again in the men that I sponsor and the shares that I hear in meetings, is because we grew up in some level of craziness or other that we somehow feel responsible for. We grew up with mixed signals and confusion and abandonment and violence, and we took it on. We thought it was our fault. We thought fixing it was our responsibility. So we come into our adult lives behaving in exactly the same way. And part of the reason we have to do inventories is because it's so automatic that we believe that seeing our world that way is the only way the world could possibly be. And reacting to it that way is the only way we could possibly react. And so many times that's just wrong. So that's what the inventory process was for me. It helped me to identify those places where I behaved badly. And by this time, what I'm starting to realize is that it's not just my daughter, the alcoholic. Not just that stone in that shoe. I behave badly, guess what? In employment situations. I mean, God bless the guy who talked about yelling at bosses and storming out of the meetings. It's like, yeah, right? Yeah, even if you don't do it there. Even if it is supposedly a professional place with ties and... I behave badly. I did it badly in work situations that had nothing to do with alcoholics. I did it in my marriages. Oof, what a mess. I won't even start to tell you about the stuff I came up with in my relationship history. I did it with my family. Over and over again, I find places where I'm behaving badly. By this time, my alcoholic daughter is almost an afterthought. I've got work to do. So at any rate, we've got all this stuff that we find in our inventory. We find where we have character defects. And a good, thorough inventory is also going to show us some things that some of us have a hard time recognizing, and that is character assets. You know, a big part of what we do in Al-Anon recovery, at least in the men that I'm exposed to, is to try to figure out how to wrap our heads around the idea that we're really not so bad after all, and it really isn't all our fault, and that we don't have to go around fixing everything. And one way to go about doing that is to recognize our character assets. You know, I can't tell you how many times guys call me up and I have to tell them, whoa, slow down. And, you know, it takes a minute for us to realize that we're good people trying really hard. It's just that the techniques we employ are so screwed up. And so what we do then is we take the stuff that we've learned from the inventory and we move on towards the amends steps. And the 6 and 7 steps are sort of a bridge to that. 6 step says that we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, which, you know, in the AA big book where those steps are first introduced, the 6 and 7 steps get about this much space. And, you know, I think it's because Bill wanted there to be 12 and not 10 steps, maybe. But they really are important because the 6th step, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's really asking me, in the one example I gave, to say that my need to fix my daughter's discomfort by pulling keys and wallets out of my pockets is a character defect because, primarily, I'm doing something that I don't necessarily really have the time or the money or the inclination to do that I wouldn't otherwise do. And, by the way, that she hasn't asked me to do. One of the most profound things I ever heard in an Al-Anon meeting was someone said, "Wait for the question mark." What? So I have to be ready to sit there and listen to this child do her thing, and just shh. We talk around here, we have a little acronym that I'm not going to translate in public. STFU. Just shh. Right? Just sit in it. Just, we sometimes have to sit in it. And I think a lot of my Al-Anon recovery is just emotion management. Just, hate it when that child's uncomfortable and pissing and moaning the way she does. So the 6th step's really asking me a difficult question. Are you ready not to do that stuff? I do that stuff because I think it's going to make things better. It's going to make me more comfortable. It's going to fix things. You know, somehow it must be my responsibility, therefore I have to fix it. 6th step says, are you ready not to do that stuff? Are you ready to be a different guy? 7th step says we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, which means, again, whether you believe in God or don't, that we're not engaged in this process by ourselves. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now, one of the difficult things for me to understand when I first started to look at the 6 and 7 steps is that even though the 7th step says humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, nowhere in those steps does it say that anything's actually removed. If it were, it'd be a 7-step program, right? I mean, it's just, it doesn't work that way. The 7th step is just saying, okay, so if you're willing to have the stuff removed and you're going to ask for it to be removed, then you get to go on to the next part of the process. And in many ways, the 8th and 9th steps, I think, are among the most powerful and profound parts of the 12-step process, because the 8th and 9th steps, the amend steps, are where we really start to get to work and changing what we do. 8th step says, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And again, that list, if you do the steps the way I do them, you've already got most of it already on your inventory. And it's asking us to examine the different places in our lives where we interact with people in that unhealthy way. And it says, by the way, are you ready? Again, are you ready to make amends to them? The 9th step says, made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And that tells us a couple of things. We want to make the amends directly. And the other one is that we also don't want to go about it in a way that's going to be harmful to others. And to me, I think one of the most vitally important parts about this part of the process is that the word amend doesn't mean apologize. The word amend means to improve, to change for the better. We write an amendment to the Constitution. And you know, that made me a little uncomfortable when I first started to look at it, because I thought, especially if you read the AA literature, where, you know, the alcoholic's coming around and saying, man, I'm so sorry I crashed your car. I'm so sorry I ripped you off. I'm so sorry I did that with your wife. You know, they've got some wreckage that they've got to go fix. And boy, I'll tell you what, they've really got some stuff to be sorry for. But for me, if the amends process was about saying I'm sorry, it would have been meaningless. Because the cheapest phrase in my vocabulary is, I'm sorry. You know, I'll say I'm sorry at the drop of a hat. And because I'm the guy that I am, I will apologize for stuff that's not remotely my fault. Nothing to do with me. God, I can't believe it, I broke a nail. Oh, I'm sorry. But more importantly, I will apologize for stuff that I've done and then go back out and do it again. I'm sorry, I just don't want you upset. I'm not necessarily going to take responsibility for anything I did to upset you, but I don't want you upset. The amends process asks me to change my behavior. So again, using the example that I have been with my daughter, my amends to her with regard to that part of our relationship was to go to her and say, you know what, Julie, I've started to realize that we have this little dance that we do where you will express a discomfort or a need or a want, saying that you don't have something, you want something, and then I will volunteer to help make it better. In the future, what I would like to work toward is that if you want something from me, I would really like for you to ask for it. This girl's smart, wicked smart. I could tell from the look on her face that she knew the jig was up. Like, oh. And to this day, she hates to actually ask. I help her a little bit. I say, honey, if you need my help, just ask. I do. I will do that because I know how hard it is for her. But she knew that at that moment, that little dance that made it so easy for her to get what she wanted and completely freed her of any responsibility for having asked for it was going to change. So that was my amends. I didn't go and apologize. I just said, here's how we're going to do it now. The upshot of that has been, fast forward many years later, I'm at dinner with her and the daughter I never talk about because she's a good kid. Probably one of us. And my oldest is talking about her boyfriend, who, by the way, she's living with and whose child she has, and how horrible he is and how unhappy she is and how, oh, what a failure this relationship is. And it's all I can do not to volunteer advice or help or whatever. It's all I can do. I'm biting my tongue. I'm bleeding. It's just, I say nothing, nothing. 3 weeks later, we go out to dinner again. Oh, God, I'm so in love. Sean is so wonderful. I was feeling pretty proud of myself for having kept my mouth shut. Oh, can you imagine if I'd said something bad about the boyfriend? Ooh, they're married now. So it's been pretty powerful and pretty valuable for me to engage in that amends process and to change the way that I act and to show up and do the right thing. And, you know, I went to an employer of mine after I'd done my inventory and I'd made a list of amends, because this one employer, I had not been a good employee. I just hadn't, in many ways beyond storming out of meetings. You know, I had just kind of skated through in a lot of ways and behaved badly with the staff and just all kinds of things that we ought not to talk about in public. And so I came to him, and this was years later. And so I stopped by. We'd had a couple of professional encounters in the meantime, and I dropped by. I said hello. We chatted about business. And then I said to him, you know, I just really want to apologize for the guy that I was when I worked here. I just want you to know that I've really gone about the business of trying to be a better employee. And the look on his face was like when you're saying something to your dog that he doesn't understand. His head kind of tilted, and I just thought, yeah, see, it's because the amends process isn't really about apologizing. And so when it's an employer you don't work for anymore, what I have to remember is that what I've learned about the guy that I was as an employee needs to be changed to my current employment situation. And again, this notion of accept when to do so would injure them or others. I'm not going to go back to my ex-wives and say to them, just saying, and say to them, I'm so sorry that I did this and this and this and this and this and this and this. There's no point in doing that.
except when to do so would injure them or others. But I am absolutely going to go about the business of taking what I've learned about myself and the way I behave in a relationship into the relationship I'm in today and become a different guy. I'm making amends. I'm changing my behavior. I'm trying to become a better guy. The most valuable thing about this process is that it helps to attack the beliefs that are underneath our behaviors. I go out there and I act like a better guy. I am a better man in a relationship. I'm a better employee. I'm a better father. And what happens is that when you act better out there and you stop doing some of the screwball things that we do, your relationships are bound to improve. If nothing else, just showing up and giving an honest effort at work compared to what I used to do was going to make things better in my professional life. As the relationships around you start to improve because you've changed your part in it, it's awfully hard to continue to believe about yourself that it's all my fault, that I'm a horrible person, that I'm not worthy of a good job or a good love or good relationships. Things start to change. And our outside reality starts to attack that belief. And to me, that's why this process is so powerful. It's so powerful that in the 10th step, it says, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Only part of the process that's repeated. And I believe that the 10th step is shorthand for it. Continue to take inventory. Continue to look at your behavior and figure out where it needs to be improved. 4 through 9 gets repeated in the 10th step. And by doing that, we continue to find places and ways where our behavior gets to be improved. Needs to be, but gets to be. The 11th step then says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, by the time I got to the 11th step, the idea of praying wasn't particularly distasteful to me. But the notion of meditation was one that I just couldn't wrap my head around. My world is fast, man. I am busy, right? And so to slow this thing down at all was a really difficult concept. I went to an outside source and got lessons. And I'll tell you what, they call it the practice of meditation. There's a good reason they call that. But I couldn't sit still for more than a couple of minutes for a long time. And again, I think that the 11th step is just one more place where we show that we want you to believe that your world's going to be okay, that you can ask for help and then just sit quietly and allow whatever is to be, which is profoundly different than the way I used to live my life, and I think the way most of us live our lives. We're busy chasing after the alcoholic. We're busy taking care of stuff. We're busy trying to justify our existence and be worthy of love. The 11th step just says, stop. Get right with yourself and whatever force there is in the universe that can help you feel better about yourself. Then the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, tried to practice these principles, carry this message to others and practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, I tell you what, I did not come in here seeking a spiritual experience of any sort. All I wanted was for my daughter to stop behaving that way. And then once I figured out that she wasn't necessarily going to stop, all I wanted was to be okay with it. But what has happened to me as a result of the process of the steps, as a result of being with men like this tonight, is that I have had a spiritual experience. And much like my relationship with the God word, my relationship with the spiritual word has changed profoundly. I don't think that I've ever had a situation where I've been levitated. I don't think I've ever seen the clouds part. But I do believe that I've had spiritual experiences. I've had experiences where I can come to believe that things are going to be okay. I've had experiences where I believe that I'm okay. And I've certainly had profound experiences in my relationships with the men in this program. And then we carry this message to others. I am so blessed. I get to work with a lot of guys. And ladies, I'm sorry, but you don't know what this place is like on Thursday nights when you're not here. It's a powerful place where men get to open up and be honest and get to set aside all that John Wayne nonsense and just say, I have no idea. And then you see the light come on in their eyes and they go, I think I have an idea. I have a little meeting in my garage on Wednesdays for the men that I sponsor. And we have some pretty good stuff going on. And that's how we carry the message. And of course, I'm blessed to be able to do this because I have a lot of fun with it. But we carry the message by just sitting in a meeting and nodding our heads and understanding. I was so absolutely amazed when I sat in a meeting with men in it and listened to other guys talk about how they couldn't handle their teenage child either. And I thought, wow, really? I thought it was just me. And then the notion of practicing these principles in all our affairs, I think, is perhaps the greatest gift that we get in recovery. Because we come in here focused on that one thing. I thought my life was just fine if only my daughter would change. And what I've realized through the inventory process and from watching the men around me is that my life wasn't just fine. I was in a marriage that was about to fall apart. I was in a crappy little job that I was about to lose. And I had really poor relationships with the people around me, friends and family. And so by understanding better about who I am and how I act and what I believe, I've gotten to address those things in all of those areas. So I did lose that job that I was in when I first came in and got a better one. And then after that, somebody said, I like the way you work. I want you to come work with me someday. And today, I've got the most amazing job I've ever had. I can't believe that I'm in this work situation. And they know me now, 4 years later, and they say, good job. I'm thinking, who are you talking to? It's absolutely the truth, because I've been willing to... So many of the dopey little things that you hear in here that I thought were just complete throwaways.
Keep coming back. Keep coming back.
But that, I'll tell you what, you just take that into the workplace. Keep coming back. I don't want to go to work tomorrow.
Keep coming back.
Who knew? That marriage fell apart. I got into another relationship with a woman who was in program, and boy, we were poster children, right?
Yeah.
We spoke and stuff. We sponsored people. And that relationship blew up 2 years ago, and I was all kinds of broken up. But you know what I did? I did a four-step on her. And I joined a group of men who were recovering from relationships that had ended. And I went to therapy, and I wrote about it, and I prayed about it. And I sat alone for a minute, and I hurt about it. And then I started dating again. And that was really horrible. I need to do a four-step on Match.com. Just saying. But guess what? After a minute, the dating started to kind of work out okay. And I was dating a couple of girls. And I'm like, hey, this is great. It was great, Stacey. Come on. Hater. And then I realized that the more unlikely of the two that I was dating, I really liked. I mean, I really liked her. And she drinks a little bit. And some of the Al-Anon men that I know are saying, dude, you're dating a woman who drinks? See, yeah, I don't care if she drinks. The only question I ever ask is, how does she treat me? She treats me really well. She's also really smart. She gets some of this stuff that I've had to do inventories over and go to meetings and call my sponsor. And she's like, hey, don't be a dumbass. I was like, oh, okay. Actually, you know what she does? Here's the one that just completely screws me up. We'll be going back and forth about something, and I'll be talking about something about feelings. And she goes, what would you tell one of your guys? Oh. She is. She's really smart. We're engaged to be married, and she's a great woman. I have never been happier. I have never been happier. And it's only because of the things I learned about the man I was in relationships that I could approach this really challenging relationship and be as happy as I am. My mother confessed to me recently that I would call the house occasionally. They never called me. I always called them. And my dad would pick up the phone, and he'd be on the phone, and he would look at her and say, it's Josiah. Do you want to talk to him? And she would do this. Well, about 2 years ago, my dad passed suddenly out of nowhere. And my parents had been married for 60 years, and she lives alone in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of nothing, New York, with a cornfield in the backyard. I mean, nothing. And so what you guys have taught me is that we're always there for each other. And so I made a commitment to call my mother every day. And the number of days that I've missed in the 2 years that have passed, I can count on my hands. And she and I have the most profound and ridiculous relationship. And she tells me how much she loves me and how much she appreciates my support. And she was able to tell that story to my fiance and laugh about it because we've come so far and things are so different. That daughter of mine that I came in here about is now 29, has a baby. She just got married. And she and I have a relationship when she wants to. Sometimes she doesn't want to. And sometimes she bails out. And I've learned to adopt the idea that I'm going to be your dad for the rest of my life. I will outweigh you. And that gives her the dignity to do whatever it is she does, and for me not to take it personally, and for me to be okay about it. I am as powerless over that alcoholic today as I ever was. She is as bat crazy as she's ever been. I'm pretty sure she smokes pot every day. She's a great mom. She's a loving wife. And she's a good daughter. On her terms that I'm okay with, because I don't allow it to hurt me in any way. My relationship with my youngest daughter, the daughter I never talk about, is amazing and great. We go and hang out, her and her boyfriend. We have a great time. So what I'm telling you is that I came in here because I was convinced that the alcoholic was making my life absolutely unbearable. What I learned as a result of the process of the 12 steps and the courage and honesty of the men who walked before me is that really the reason that that was an unhealthy and just unworkable way of living is because of the things that I did and the things that I believed about myself. Through the process of the steps, I've learned slowly, glacially slowly, how to change the way that I act, and that in turn gets to change the way that I believe. And today I've got a life beyond my wildest expectations. I love you guys. Thank you.